Welcome to Care in Action, the podcast by Care Austria, with Andrea Barstorff-Hager.
Welcome to another episode of Care in Action, the podcast of Care Austria. And today we are honored to welcome a global visionary in urban development, United Nations UNRWA Secretary General Anna Claudia Rosbach, Executive Director of UN Habitat. Mrs. Rosbach brings over 20 years of expertise in housing rights and urban policy to the table. From her impactful work at the World Bank to leading initiatives for informal settlements across the Global South, she's a driving force for sustainable and inclusive cities. Anna Claudia Rosbach, it's a true privilege to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Andrea. It's a great privilege and an honor for me to be with you today and this audience.
Super. So let's get started. And I would ask you kindly to briefly share your journey into urban development and how you came to work in this field, but also when did you join and how did you join UN Habitat?
Well, maybe the easiest part is when I joined UN Habitat, which is about 2 years ago in August 24, after this specific career on urban development, which is actually my second professional life, to say so. But when I really started was towards the end of the 90s, when I was professionally kind of reinventing myself. I was working previously for the private sector in a big major international auditing consultancy company. And I returned to Brazil after living a couple of years abroad, and entered my master's degree. And I joined a laboratory, research laboratory on social economics. And there I started researching aspects such as crime and violence and health, public health, the intersection on economics. And one of the topics that we looked at was the high criminality rates in the city of São Paulo, where I lived, affecting mostly young male and around or in informal settlements, slums. Mm-hmm. So this was my starting point. So what is that? You know, why this high prevalence of crime around slums, and why do we have slums and mm-hmm. informal settlements?
In Brazil, the famous favelas.
The favelas.
Exactly. I have also studied in Brazil and lived there for more than 2 years. And especially São Paulo, but this was many years ago. This was more than 35 years ago. And I was very young then, obviously. And I was never afraid in São Paulo. Maybe it was because I was so young.
Maybe.
That I didn't notice it. I was cautious. I lived with a Brazilian wealthy family. Mm-hmm. And I learned there that I have to close the car when we go somewhere. And I do that until today. So many habits that I picked up during my time in Brazil, I kept, and so I was always safe. So what is the reason? What did you find out in this study? What is the reason for the high prevalence of crime around favelas? Obviously, it's poverty, isn't it?
Yeah, well, poverty, but not only, because there were other poverty situations that, I mean, there are. Like, look, at this moment, we looked at, for example, Kerala in India. Mm-hmm. We had poverty, but also not this high rates of crime and violence, right? So multiple factors, of course, these areas are segregated, marginalized from the cities, so there are less opportunities, especially for young people, and they provide the best environment for non-licit activities, right? Because mm-hmm. we're talking about areas that have that are not integrated to the city in terms of city lights, they have less public spaces, so lots of hidden areas, areas that are not accessible, that, you know, the whole city, like police, you know, the state actors cannot see much.
It's
right.
Like a hidden city in the city. Could
yes.
one say that?
I think so. Mm-hmm. I think so. Especially in São Paulo. In other places in Brazil, like Rio, for example, you can see mm-hmm. the favelas on the mountains, on the hills. But in São Paulo, not so much.
No, you don't see them if you don't go there intentionally.
Exactly.
You don't see them so easy. And for Rio, I would say they are a bit romanticized even, isn't it?
I think so.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not Brazilian, but I always have had a big passion for Brazil. But my many tourists that go to Rio do a tour through the favelas. I would not recommend that.
Yeah, that's this aspect too. Yeah, it's affecting other places in the world too. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't know details about this tourism industry in favelas and how it is eventually benefiting also people there
that
as a business. I cannot offer an opinion, but I do agree that it is romanticized, and actually we need to be actually pragmatic and have the right policies to address these areas. But what I realized in this research is that basically the favelas were there because during the urbanization period of Brazil, cities have not prepared themselves to receive this contingent of population. Mm-hmm. And also the housing policies, they were not comprehensive enough. So basically people moved from other parts of Brazil to São Paulo to build houses where, for example, my parents live, right? To address the needs of middle class, to say so. But they didn't have any alternative. So they started occupying any vacant space in the city, which could be a space that was previously planned to be a park or, you know, a public area or a private area that has never been developed, or risk areas around riverbanks or slopes. So these are the areas where usually people just settle themselves.
And you need not go so far to Sao Paulo or Rio. If you have an open eye in Europe, you see it more and more too.
That's what I have, listening to recently, that informality rates are increasing. I had a recent visit last year to Rome, where I heard the numbers, I think, 20,000 households in informal situations, if I'm not mistaken. And then you see the groups like the Roma community and so on. So, yeah, and perhaps some invisible situations that we cannot access, like overcrowding or precarious situations.
So it's taking space in a non-intentional infrastructured way, right? It's public space that is somehow in debate now. Who is the owner of public space, right?
Yes.
That's about your work also with UN Habitat, right?
Yes, and even the private spaces, because the new urban agenda calls for a principle called the social and ecological function of the property, meaning also that private owners, they have a responsibility vis-a-vis their buildings and land. So buildings and land that are not utilized for the benefit of the society, we need to address this situation because clearly we have people needing houses and we have buildings or spaces that are vacant and underutilized. So the cities, they have developed some instruments or mechanisms to make these buildings available to the society, right? For example, property taxes or fees, requirements, regulations that really require people to use their assets, put it in service of the society.
Mm-hmm. So 2 years ago, you joined UN Habitat, were sharing, which is not a very long time ago, and now you are based in one of the mega cities in East Africa, right? It's also housing one of the big, one of the biggest slums in East Africa, unfortunately. So what's your look at Nairobi from your current professional standpoint?
Well, actually very positive, because the government of Kenya, I have to say, they have invested a lot in affordable housing. And it's quite impressive if you look at the numbers. Mm-hmm. They have managed to raise or leverage about $4 to $5 billion US dollars domestically.
In Kenya.
Mm-hmm. And they have managed to build about 276,000 units within 3 years, which is a very short period of time.
And it's a growing city, correct?
It is a growing city. It is receiving population. Mm-hmm. So Africa in total The numbers that we have is that Africa might be receiving about 1 billion people in the next couple of decades. So you need to house, right? But and then you need the infrastructure and the integration to the city and so on. What I see now in Kenya is that there are major plans. So the housing, they have been built and delivered so far. Some of them are dedicated to address the needs of informal settlements. For example, the Mukuru housing project, where people are moving from shacks, from very precarious situations to apartments. There are plans for other major urban infrastructure projects and resources that have been raised. For example, sewage programs, but all dealing with urban mobility, transportation, and so on. There are still many challenges, right? Because also moving people from informal settlements or slums to apartments, high-rise, requires a strong social support, the management of the facilities and so on. So from that stage to full sustainability, also the financial sustainability of the scheme that has been so far funded by levies that were launched by the state. There are many question marks that the government is pretty much aware of and working with several organizations, private organizations, public, international, with us, so that we can look at how it can be sustainable and also connected to the overall kind of environment that's needed.
Is the type of housing that is your home, is this helping you in also moving from the informal or shadow economy more to the official work?
For sure, because the first issue, the first aspect of that is the address. Because if you don't have an address, you have nothing. It's difficult to find a place at school for a child that doesn't have an address. Imagine a young entrepreneur or a woman entrepreneur that is willing to start a business. You need an address. To find a job, a formal job, you need an address.
To be bankable?
To be bankable, to have access to a microloan or to any types, you need an address. So yes, it is a critical entry point.
So it's really also a political strategic decision, not only philanthropy or sort of social support, to get rid of slums and to enable people to participate in their own urban society, right?
Yeah, well, some informal settlements, we are talking globally now, right? Some informal settlements, they can be upgraded. They can be improved and integrated to the city, right? And in Latin America, for example, you have many examples of cities, countries that have invested in upgrading. Medellin in Colombia is a classic example, but we have been seeing slum upgrading integrations in Argentina, in Chile, in Mexico, in Central America, Brazil.
So these became then poorer districts of large cities, right?
Well, yes, or also even secondary cities in metropolitan areas. There are many examples. So they become, so they are earmarked, they are officially embedded into the master plan, into the city plan. You give an address, you formalize the titles, the ownership, and there is a continuum. Different countries, they have a continuum of property rights, right? It doesn't have to be like a final formal title, but there are different types of concessions and certificates and so on. So continuum.
But it's a rent-based system,
of formalization.
Right?
Not only. In some places, yes. I think in the case of Colombia, for example, there's a high prevalence of rentals. But in many cases, it's also ownership. Yeah. People own households. They own their houses in the informal settlements. In Asia, in India, for example, there's a lot of rental schemes within the slums. But it's not the same across the globe.
And to make this happen, who is the seed investor to for such a big step? Is it by a large organization, or is it UN Habitat who initiates that? Is it tax money?
So the seed investor, I would say, step back, people themselves.
Okay. Okay.
Because they have been investing already, right? Mm-hmm. They have been building their houses. Mm-hmm. In some places, they come together, they build even, you know, community facilities, they build a little bit of infrastructure like public toilets and, mm-hmm. and things like that. So people have been investing. Actually, people are the biggest investors in housing in the world. I mean, the majority of the housing that we have, they have been built by the people themselves. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But then, of course, I do believe we need some public resources in terms of public investments in these areas. Could be the national government, ideally, of course, the local government that has more access to the communities and can interact and create participation mechanisms, listen to the co-create, actually, mm-hmm. the development.
The new password, co-creating,
yeah. Co-create,
right?
Co-create, yeah. But we know that not all cities are equipped in terms of human resources or financial resources to do that, so the national government can step in. An interesting case about Brazil, when the country was up to launch the large country-wise, large-scale slum upgrading program, mm-hmm. Back in 2000, around 2005-06, the program was launched in 2007. There was a whole discussion among economists whether the national government could put more money as investments in slums. And the economists, I am an economist, by the way, so I can talk.
I was guessing that, to be honest. I would have asked you throughout our conversation, but it was clear also to our appreciated listeners that you are an economist.
Yeah, economists, my colleagues at that time, they said, look, we cannot do that because we cannot increase the public social expenditures. This goes against IMF rules and so mm-hmm. on and so forth. So he said, the president at this time said, okay, let's discuss with the IMF. And President Lula at this time made the case that when you put public money in slums, it's not only a social expenditure, it is an investment.
An infrastructural investment.
Investment.
By the way, the IMF is the International Monetary Fund, who is a big partner to many countries, not only, but mainly in the so-called global south. From where you sit, Ana Claudia, would you say that it's safer nowadays? Let's talk about Brazil, because you have...
Safer the Islam?
Is it safer? Yeah.
I don't think so.
Neither do I. That's why I asked.
I don't think so. I don't know the exact numbers right now. But the situation improved a lot. Perhaps it is safer in different aspects for the people living there. Mm-hmm. For example, women. There are cases of slums, informal settlements, transformations where, you know, using street lights and safer spaces and services and so on. Mm-hmm. So in several ways, in several locations, it became mm-hmm. safer, let's hope. But we still have, some way to go. But also, we have to consider that housing policy or urban infrastructure policy, slum transformation, they do have an economic impact, but they're not sufficient for us to overcome as a society poverty and inequalities.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the steps, but not the only one, right? And
exactly.
You can't expect miracles.
You cannot expect miracles.
So it's about education.
Moving a family from a slum to an apartment will not solve all the problems. Mm-hmm.
But it will create maybe new ones even, right?
Maybe new ones. It will bring this household to a different level because, as I said, they mm-hmm. will have an address. Kids will come back from school and have a safe place to do their homework. They will stay healthier, right?
Access to clean water, I assume, in many cases, right?
Access in many, many cases. Access to mm-hmm. the basics, right, mm-hmm. that we are used mm-hmm. to. But they're not sufficient. If their overall macroeconomic conditions mm-hmm. don't improve, they might even be obliged to kind of sell this asset and go back to survive. Mm-hmm. You understand what I'm saying? So We need major measures to overcome poverty and inequality. Access to housing is a critical one, and can change completely the game for many families in many situations, but it's not sufficient.
And it's not changing the whole society.
It's not changing the whole society.
And from where you sit and from your perspective, what are the best examples you would say? Can you say that? Where some cities really are dealing well with it and not stopping at the aspect of housing, which is a very big step because cities are growing everywhere, right?
Yeah.
And most of the population are moving to the big cities. This is not a phenomenon only of the global south. We see that metropolitan areas are getting larger and larger, and these are facing new challenges that are not solved yet. So do you have good examples apart from Nairobi, where this is really dealt with a longer-term perspective and including more aspects of fighting poverty than only housing, which is a key one, but as we said, it's not a solution to everything.
No, perhaps to start with the city where we are now doing this podcast. Vienna has been a great model for housing policies historically. We have been promoting this model, and it's pretty much holistic in terms of, you know, providing communities a space to co-live and co-create and connecting these houses to the whole city, to services, but also to opportunities. And there's a whole social component, right, mm-hmm. that's connected to the housing component and designed and prioritized according to the context, to the current needs, migration flows, demographic changes. So you have aging population, mm-hmm. you have young people, you know, coming to cities, so different, you know, aspects of the urbanization process, where throughout the years, the city here in Vienna has been changing and improving the housing. So I think it's a great example. Of course, not all the cities, they have the capacity, financial capacity.
Vienna is rather small. I mean, we are rather small and rather rich, I would say.
Yeah, that's correct.
With one of the highest tax levels in the world.
That's correct. That's correct, yeah. But there are some principles, yeah. right, that can be followed. And we see all over the world cities, you know, in the past, and we have to look at cities historically, right? How cities in certain moments of their history mm-hmm. were able to cope with the challenge. If you look Europe, even the US, they used to have prevalence of slums and informality, mm-hmm. and they changed that, right? Mm-hmm. Through several, you know, measures and cycles, including wars and reconstructions, mm-hmm. right? And so situation changes. So you can say they successfully mm-hmm. Dealt with the issues with the acute issues of informalities and informal settlements. Now they are facing different problems. Mm-hmm. It's still a housing crisis, affordability problems, the energy transition. So there are other issues that are happening here. And of course, we have the climate mm-hmm. that is requiring
impacting all of us. What would you say about China?
Heat
the
waves.
Development of Chinese cities?
Very impressive.
Why? Because that's what I saw on a private level.
Yeah.
And it is, I think it's super tough for the people that are moved. Mm-hmm. But for the urban development, it's impressive.
It is very impressive. Mm-hmm. I think it's one of the cases that we have been highlighting also mm-hmm. as UN Habitat. Urban transformation is possible. Right.
And maybe not very inclusive, but it's possible and visible.
Well, in a way, I mean, if you start to plan the city with more public spaces, mm. this is inclusion, right? Mm. Or with a concept of proximity, which is quite prevalent. Also here in Europe, mm. The city of Paris has put yeah. social housing well located, mm-hmm. The concept of proximity of services. Has it solved the problem? Not. But advancing towards the solution. Mm-hmm. The air quality in the Chinese cities to stay in China, I mean, this is benefiting the whole of mm-hmm. the society. Some technologies they have developed to be more prepared for disasters. For example, the sponge cities technology that absorbs and improves the drainage capacity of cities, minimizing the risks of flooding. This has been also exported. We are actually supporting this knowledge transfer to cities in to Nairobi, to cities in Brazil, and other places.
This is a big issue that when heavy rains come, that everything is flooded. And if you think about poorer districts, then this is really a health issue and a health risk.
Yeah.
And many things are connected to the negative impact of urban flooding, right?
Yeah. I'm reading here CARE. In Latin America, the concept of cities of care has been gaining a lot of traction. For example, the city of Bogota, the former mayor has established the neighborhoods of care, which is a very interesting concept. It's identifying spaces in the cities, territory in the cities, with high levels of vulnerability and making sure that there is a range of services around where people live. So especially for women, so that women can leave their houses in the morning, literally do that. Drop the child in the crèche, the kindergarten. Drop the parents, the elderly family members in a daycare. Then drop the laundry in another place. Go to another place to learn whatever, computer sciences, skills, and so on. Or just, you know, go to school or just go to find a job or to, start some business activities and so on. Similar concept is being now implemented by the mayor of Mexico City, which was previously the mayor of Iztapalapa. She established this concept of utopias that I just heard last week from the mayor of Quito that they have also established in Quito, the Quitopias. So this concept of preparing neighborhoods to be a physical part of the care system and embedding even in master plans, in urban master plans, in zoning, that's quite interesting, right?
It's interesting, and this is something that the city of Vienna is also doing. It's called differently, but the idea that you have all the social services that you need and also access to medical care and things like that in your neighborhood and in walking distance, this is one part of the concept. And the second part is that we connect all areas, all urban living areas by public transport, which is also key, because how do people move in a city, and how do people commute, and how much time of a day they spend commuting, right? These are all big issues for all of us, not only the so-called Global South cities.
Yeah.
They have different infrastructural plans, I would assume, but some things we really are sharing, right?
Yeah, and accessibility is a major challenge, especially if we think about aging population, persons with disabilities, discapacities. So it's very important that cities are prepared for the demographic changes that we have ahead of us. Not only Europe, Latin America, is also aging.
Is it also an aging population?
Yes.
Because
now it's
in Nairobi, that's not the issue, I would say. Many African countries, not so much. Right?
In Africa in general, the pyramid looks different than in the future. The demographic, we're talking about people coming to cities and predominantly young people.
Yeah.
So it's pretty much young. But Latin America is starting also to face aging. Yeah.
Europe, it's extreme. Europe. And in Japan, you can see what happens.
You have entire towns. I mean, even in Europe, towns that have been left behind, and now the governments are trying to attract young people, establishing policies. There's a mismatch, right? We need houses in one place. We have houses in other places.
Yeah.
But in general, we have to prepare the cities as a whole. It's about housing, but cities as a whole, how they are accessible, how they are prepared for persons with disabilities with the conflicts that we are facing. People coming back to their towns and they have to
how
should
they
live.
Cope if
how
you only have cope? One leg left or
exactly
like that,
exactly
which we see not only on the media, which is a living reality for thousands of people in the Middle East, in Ukraine, in all these areas, you name it. So is that something you would say from your perspective that city planners and politicians are open to and willing to cooperate and listen to what organizations like UN Habitat and others are suggesting? Or is it rather difficult to convince them?
No, I don't think it's difficult to convince. I think we achieved a stage, and we're just coming from this big conference, the World Urban Forum. 58,000 people participated. And what I realized, even with the financial institutions, at this point, we are speaking the same language. Because if we talk about housing, if we talk about quality of life in cities, mm-hmm. you know, nobody's against. It's a common denominator, you know, for...
It's easy to understand.
It's easy yeah. to understand. Mm-hmm. There's no political polarization on that in terms of, mm-hmm. of the end, right? The end game. We want everybody to live better. Yes. We want everybody to live in a decent, adequate house.
Safer
house.
But
yes.
Who defines that for which...
we have a normative role, UN mm-hmm. Habitat, in that sense.
If I'm asking, yeah.
Yeah. So currently, one critical intergovernmental process that we have been facilitating member states through is the open-ended working group on housing. Mm-hmm. And we are revisiting some definitions. We are establishing some unexisting definitions and looking at policy recommendations and practices. So the working group has started 2 years ago. It's going to be active until 29. And basically, we revisited, for example, the definition on adequate housing, because our definition didn't include, that we had previously, didn't include the aspect of sustainability, because it was designed before the context that we mm-hmm. are living now in terms of climate pressure. We don't have, Andrea, a global definition for homelessness. And we don't have a global definition. Yeah, I see your face. We don't have a global definition for informal settlements.
Okay.
Yes.
So this is something that is a phenomena that is defined by the space where it happens or what?
Well, there are several definitions. Some cities have their own definitions. Some countries, they have their own definitions. But what happens is we say we have about 300 million people living in, homelessness. But we don't know exactly, I mean, the statistics are not aligned because the definitions that people use are different. And some places, they don't count, even informal settlements, they don't include. So now we are working with this open-ended working group on having a global definition, understanding that the local definitions will continue and so on, but at least we have a unified parameter also for informal settlements, and a set of policy recommendations. We already have a couple on finance. So how can we deal with the finances to address the housing crisis? Social housing, which are the policies, which are the trends, what are mm-hmm. the key recommendations? Like what you said, the integration with the social policies, mm-hmm. the city and so on, the proximity.
Do you have a number for us? What is the adequate size in social housing? Because in Vienna, I know it, that it's about 40 square meters per person, more or less. Mm-hmm. I guess this is completely different in Asian cities like Hong Kong, right?
Well, yeah, we don't have the habitat we don't have in terms of size. No, we don't have, no.
Not even a recommendation?
We don't have a recommendation.
Okay.
No, we don't have a recommendation.
And do you think it would be, this is the case because you can't define it on a global level?
Perhaps, and also thinking about feasibility, right? What's mm-hmm. possible to be done in many places, but it hasn't been actually raised, mm-hmm. been raised by member states, for example, in this open-ended working group. Mm-hmm. It's the first time since I took my position that this come to me, like why we don't have a global with this question. No, it has not been raised. We actually we propose and we react to member states. Yeah, mm-hmm. We could think about proposing that to member states. I'm not sure if how helpful it will be at this point in time or not. I think at the moment it's important that we have some common definitions mm-hmm. that we are able to measure the issue and we agree on policy recommendations. And it hasn't been difficult to agree on these policy recommendations that I mentioned to you.
It's a good thing. Sometimes it's very difficult, as you know, to agree on
very, very
recommendations.
Yeah, I think we have a very good Yeah, kind of consensus in terms of cities and housing. Everybody agrees on proximity. Nobody, as we don't have, everybody agrees that we need to have, you know, urban mobility that has to be sustainable in terms of air quality.
Yeah, otherwise, it's not livable. I think this is part of the success of Chinese cities to clean the air. They had to do something because you couldn't breathe anymore.
Yeah, clean the air and clean the noise because you go to big cities and don't listen to anything.
Right? Exactly. It correlates somehow. Also, Delhi did a lot.
This is
when I started going to New Delhi, you couldn't even breathe in the morning.
Yeah.
Nowadays, it's much better. So, electromobility, many Asian states are far more advanced than we are, right, in Europe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And this is now cascading to other places like Kenya. There are many, many projects. I was just watching the other day the TV. I mean, this e-mobility industry with the crisis that we are facing right now and the fuel prices, the e-mobility industry in Kenya is gaining traction. So, yeah, there are interesting things happening.
That's true. So who are the main partners? It's on an governmental level, right? The UN Habitat is working.
Well, we are the UN, United Nations. So, yeah, we work. We have to address the requests and respond to member states. Yeah.
What would you say is the main request at the moment?
Well, I could say housing because 105 member states attended our UN Habitat Assembly last year and they approved our strategic plan, which focuses on housing, access to land, basic services, and the transformation of informal settlements. They have set up this priority for UN Habitat.
Access to land outside urban areas or inside?
No, inside. Yeah, yeah.
And is it about the entitlement of the land? Am I the owner? Am I only renting it? Is it about that?
It is about making sure, it's about several things. So first of all, really increasing the supply of land and access to land for housing. So that's that, which includes also the regularization of informal settlements, discontinuing of land rights. It has to do with equal rights in terms of land ownership for women. For example.
Isn't that a difficult topic? Easy that people agree on that?
No, it's not agreement. It's the legal systems, the customary laws, and so on. So there's an issue about, especially in Africa, you have the customary systems and the legal system. So access to land implies on, you know, aligning all that and making sure that ownership of land, access to land, you know, is equal to everybody and enables adequate housing provision to all.
So this is not so much advanced when I listen to you?
Well, no, I think we have progress. What I think we have, Andrea, we have the solutions.
Okay, but it's not implemented yet.
In some places, yes, but we have a long way to go.
I'm asking,
as a global society, let's say so.
I'm asking that much exactly on this point because, as you for sure know, CARE is focusing in particular on women and girls. And we see that it is really one of the most pressing issues that women especially have land, real land ownership, especially in many, not only in African context, but in general, what happens to them if they wish to divorce? What happens to them in case that they become widows? How sustainable is their ownership title and how can they defend it, especially
in heritage,
when they don't have a lot of education, which is not possible for many women in the world?
It is a major issue. Women from indigenous communities, I mean, major issue. We still have a lot to go. Sometimes I tend to see the half of the glass full because I don't want to minimize the advances that we have, the technical solutions, you know, the tools that we have and places in terms that recognized, but you are right. It is a huge bottleneck. It's a huge challenge for us. And for women, it makes a total difference, especially if they are the heads of household.
Yeah. And agreement on policies is from where I see it, very important. But the implementation and to bring all this, what we put on paper in all our organizations to life, this is the biggest challenge, right?
This is the biggest challenge, yeah. Having a social contract is a challenge. Transforming the social contract into regulations, laws, institutions, the second one. And then you have to make it work for everybody. So I think there are three layers of challenges that mm-hmm. are hindering the implementation and you know, the scaling up of these initiatives. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Anna Claudia, in this moment of the podcast, I would really like to ask you, you have a very demanding job. You're on the highest level, global level, traveling a lot, working a lot. So what keeps you going privately?
Well, invitations like that.
That's very nice of you.
I can find a corner in my mission to talk to organizations like CARE, like-minded, and that are part of this big coalition for this transformation. Also, the inspiration that I get when I speak to local governments, for example, or local stakeholders, communities, and I see, you know, the energy and the efforts in changing things on the ground. There's a lot going on. And of course, many, many challenges, but there's also a lot going on. And I like to highlight there's a lot going on. And this is what keeps me inspired. And also, Andrea, I saw during my career in Brazil, from the moment where we started the podcast, I was saying, look, there's an issue here. Until now, Brazil went through a large-scale slum upgrading policy, a large-scale housing policy with more than 8 million houses being built and people moving from risk vulnerable areas to apartments, safe areas. I could visually see the effect and the transformation in people's life, people that I know, mm-hmm. and see where the second and third generations are benefiting from this physical urban transformation. Have they solved the whole problem? No. As you said, slums are still dangerous, but life has improved a lot for millions of people. And this has generational effects. So you see then, children or grandchildren of people who used to live in a shack going to college.
Which is an enormous step. Easy for people like us, but really unimaginable when you were born in a favela in Rio de Janeiro or Sao Paulo, right?
Exactly.
And so you mentioned it, Anna Claudia, that you tend to look at the full glass, that is half full and not empty. So
I don't know if it's a problem or if it's an advantage.
In my case, I would say I tend to, it depends on my daily constitution, whether the glass is half full or half empty. But I think that both of us have to be, by professional background, we have to be rather optimistic, right? Because if we are not believing that we can make it and then that life can be better for millions of people globally, then who should believe in it? What would you say to that? So
I completely agree.
Not a naive belief. I'm not talking about a naive belief, but we have to be grounded in what we are doing to achieve successes, right?
Yeah. No, I agree with you. Of course, the leadership position brings responsibilities also in terms of, you cannot bring other leaders with you if you don't have a horizon, if you don't have a vision of possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what, that's why I'm so happy that we had 58,000 people attending the World Urban Forum.
Which is enormous. Wow. And
I think the largest UN conference in terms of numbers, even bigger than the COP that happened in the same stadium in Baku,
mm-hmm.
COP29. And this is inspiring, like walking through the expo there and talking to people and seeing that people are relying.
So the stakeholders are looking for solutions. This is the message of 58,000
Many
people,
have
right?
solutions.
Yeah.
And they are bringing
want to
for
share
solutions.
It.
They want
yeah.
to share. They want to make it systemic. So they need our help to make it systemic. I mean, solutions we have. I'm not worried about solutions. Mm-hmm. Solutions, innovations, we have. Examples, illustrations. But we need the scale. And how we get to the scale? It's not through projects. We have projects are great to prove, to advance the life of certain number of people.
To
that's
pilot.
All good. To pilot, yeah. Innovate, all good. But we need the systems. Like I said, the example of Kenya leveraging the domestic finance. We need domestic finance is key.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's
not to rely on foreign investment.
There is no country in the world that addressed the housing issues at scale with international funding.
Uh-uh.
Like, look at Europe. We spoke at the beginning. The Marshall Plan was important to build the houses and reconstruct the continent after the war. But then systems were built. Housing finance systems were built. The private sector has been developed and built out of nothing, out of the ashes. So we have to look at systems and support countries and cities to leverage their own domestic side. I'm not saying that international finance is not needed. It is needed, and we have to access the climate funds, the IFIs, and so on. But use that in a smart way to de-risk investment.
To leverage domestic
exactly.
Investment. This is absolutely key, and we also see that not only now with the decrease of international aid funding, we already knew that before that in international funding should be a leverage for domestic funding and development. So I don't know if you're aware of it, but CARE is 80 years now. And you mentioned the Marshall Plan, the famous CARE packages were even part of the Marshall Plan. And this this was not altruism. This was absolutely concrete aid to come back and to come back to the economic global system. We were helped to be part of the economic global system and to rebuild out of the ashes, as you said.
And nobody thought that Europe would be depending on the US money forever, right?
No, this was not the plan.
This should be the plan for the other countries from the whole global south, for the whole global south, yeah.
Final question, maybe a bit naive, but for you personally, what would the perfect city look like in 20 or 30 years?
The perfect city?
Mm-hmm.
Well, a city where, first of all, me myself as a woman, but all the women.
We are a lot of women here now.
We are a lot of women.
We are half of the global population.
Starting with myself.
Yeah, that's good. Why not?
But you and all the women can walk freely without major concerns of safety and security to start with. A city where everybody's housed adequately. And we don't have people living on the streets. We don't have people living in precarious situations in shacks or in risk areas. Cities that are able to foresee and prepare themselves for disasters. And now we are having so many, unfortunately, and all the times, landslides, floodings, fires, all types that can prepare and can respond. Cities that have, green spaces, public spaces. Again, this city is a great example. Water surface that helps us to, protect ourselves from the heat waves, and B, have nice places just to be. Cities where children, young people, they feel safe and they can find opportunities. Cities that welcome people.
Mm-hmm. And also where the disabled and the old ones have a place,
the disabled,
right?
Disabled and the old ones, exactly, yeah.
So I think this is a wonderful vision. Our guest today, United Nations Under Secretary General Anna Claudia Rosbach, the Executive Director of UN Habitat. Anna Claudia, thanks for making the time. You were a wonderful guest. Yeah, and let's join forces to make our cities of dream happen. I have the privilege to live in one. Vienna is really a beautiful town, but there are lots of interesting and beautiful cities around the globe.
I'm sure I'm a fan of all cities. I think all cities, they have their own beauty, and they're special in different ways. And it was a pleasure to be with you. So, vielen Dank.
Yeah. Muito obrigada. Thank you, Anna Claudia.
Thank you.
See you soon. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. This was Care in Action, the podcast by Care Austria with Andrea Barstorff-Hager. For more information about Care and our projects, visit care.at. There you'll also find out how you can support our work. This podcast is made possible with the generous support of CC Real. Thank you for your commitment, which enables this series of conversations. See you next time.